I'd like to show my respect and acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are traditional custodians of the land, elders past and present on the land that we're on today. My name's Simon Batterbury. I'm from the Office of Environmental Programs here at University of Melbourne. The OEP does graduate level environmental education. You can see some of our boards and flyers up at the back in the hallway. And we have an office south of the Student Union, and we're part of the Faculty of Land and Environment, and there's some of their materials there too. We're joined in hosting this event by the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute, which coordinates research across campus. And Annie Belito from MSSI will lead the questions at the end of today's talk. And Bill McKibben's tour of Australia and New Zealand is promoting 350.org, a campaign to reduce global CO2 emissions, and he's been touring extensively across two countries. You can hear some of his media online, notably on the ABC, and thanks very much to his team, particularly John, for giving us the chance to host this event, and I'm sure he'll explain more about 350 during the course of the evening. We'll follow tonight's lecture with a vote of thanks by Ellen Sandel from the Australian Youth Climate Coalition. And we also acknowledge Environment Victoria, Beyond Zero Emissions, and other NGOs who've helped to promote tonight's event. Given that we had 5 days to prepare it, it's a bit of a tall order. And it's great to have 300 people in the room today. With great pleasure, I'd like to offer a few words of introduction on tonight's speaker, Bill McKibben. Bill's occupied the status of a leading environmental writer and commentator for about 20 years, and he also has an outstanding career as a journalist and author in the United States. I'm sure his book, $100 Holiday, which is about spending less on Christmas, will go down very well this year, given our financial crisis. Anyway, what he calls his youthful book, The End of Nature, became an international bestseller. It's published 20 years ago, and some of you may have actually read it. My own copy was purchased in the UK when I was a grad, and then I was a grad student at Clark University, New England. The book itself has covered about 20,000 book miles, which is pretty embarrassing, given the tenor of the argument of the book, which is about the incipient problems of global warming and CO2 emissions. At the time, I was working on the Earth is Transformed by Human Action project at Clark as an assistant, and that was the attempt to bring George Perkins Marsh into the 20th century, resulting in a very academic tome, very different to Bill's own contribution, which was extremely readable and has actually been translated into over 20 languages. The end of nature in the title refers, of course, to the coming to an end of a set of, and I quote, a set of human ideas about the world and our place in it. As science was beginning to show the gravity of anthropogenic change and beginning genetic modification in a serious way, Bill felt that we could no longer look at a landscape or a tree in the same way again, and forecasted that eventually our mistaken sense of nature as eternal and separate will be washed away, and we will see all too clearly what we have done. It's taken 15 years probably for that statement to be true. We now see what we've done. But the seeds were sown by Bill, Steve Schneider, and others in the US, and it's fallen to them to spread an environmental message that has major echoes back into US environmental thinking, and indeed here in Australia. A sense of loss and a certain annoyance about the intransigence of a consumerist and technologically driven society pervades end of nature. And since then, Bill has written very extensively for most of the US's major magazine publications. In Orion, for example, in 2008, he argues that having a sustainable lifestyle is just simply not going to be enough. The greatest contribution of a citizen is to lobby to promote large-scale actions by the state and corporations like international climate treaties and retooling energy generation. So that statement probably shocked a few middle-class Greens in the US. His other books include Enough, on the perils of genetic engineering, maybe one on population growth, hope, human and wild, on sustainable futures. And the major anthologies, American Earth and the Bill McKibben Reader. And his book, The Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, presents the shortcomings of the growth economy, showing how vibrant local communities are challenging globalization, especially through the localization of enterprise and food production. Now, much of this has relevance to Australia. We sit in an environmentally active city, perhaps a little bit more environmentally active than our large neighbour in New South Wales, from where Bill has just come. I'd like to think so. In a rich university, and despite Australia's low population density, we at least here are running out of water very fast. Our marine environment is deteriorating very rapidly. We're still logging native forests, and we've recently suffered tragic bushfires. Melbourne is growing outwards into bushland at such a pace that it would certainly be at home in a state like Arizona, where I lived for many years, where untrammeled urban growth was really the norm rather than the exception. Bill responds to these issues, which were born in the American context, but his ideas on these things are also relevant to us here. Following through on the sentiments of his books and articles, he's found himself promoting a simpler life, but also spearheading large-scale actions and non-violent demonstrations against lack of action on global warming. The Step It Up 07 campaign started very small and became very, very big, possibly the largest environmental campaign in US history. He's recently been at the forefront of actions at coal-fired power stations, including the Capital Power Plant in Washington, and we also have a major coal issue here in Victoria, of course. So we have a rare opportunity to hear from somebody who has transcended the divide between words and action. The talk will be about 45 minutes, something like that, up to an hour. We'll then have a vote of thanks from the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, followed by about half an hour for questions. Thanks very much.
I think I'm on.
Yes,
Simon. Okay.
Live and wired. Simon, thank you so much for that kind introduction. Thank you more for throwing together with your colleagues, with Helen, with Ellen, with so many others, this talk in such short notice. I feel extremely guilty, in a sense, that you all have come here on this beautiful day. It's such a pleasure for me. But I'm always a little worried that it's going to be more of a pleasure for me than for you, you know. My main task in the world is to depress people, and so I apologize in advance. And not only am I going to depress you, I'm going to do it really without any pictures for you to look at. I am, you know, an environmentalist, and I am, so I'm sort of at work. I always tell people on a new low-carbon technology that I call virtual PowerPoint. And if it works correctly, the pictures will appear in your head as I speak, okay? So we'll see. You let me know. I'm going to tell stories for part of this afternoon, because stories are the way that I, at least, and I think many people understand and apprehend the world, apprehend it in a way that maybe we can then act on it. And it's to action that I hope to move you before we're over. So let me begin. Let me begin with a story from very far away, from Tibet. I was a couple of years ago in Tibet doing a story for the National Geographic. And I was in a remote part of Tibet. Even for Tibet, it was remote. Village that we'd had to drive through a bunch of streams to get to, and all day, you know, in these sort of half tracks that we finally reached this village, really just a collection of six or seven huts, very far from anywhere. And we got out of the car, and there was one young man there, 17 or 18, And through the translator that I was traveling with, he offered to walk us up the valley to the foot of the glacier that overhung this little village. So up we hiked for a good hour along this river, and we finally got there and we're reclining, you know, just at the snout of this just massive Himalayan glacier, incredibly beautiful. And we were admiring it. And he pointed out this huge black rock in the middle, as big as this building easily, that was sort of there in the middle of the glacier. And he said, you know, that just appeared last year. It just melted out last year, and now it being black, it was melting out very quickly, you know, as the sun struck it. And we've lived here for, you know, many, many, many generations. This is the first time this has happened. Well, I was kind of curious. We were a long ways from radio or television or electricity or schools. He wasn't literate in the sense that we're used to thinking about it. So I was sort of, I said, why is that happening? Why is that melting out like that? I didn't know quite what I was, some story about the gods or something. It looked at me like I was, you know, visiting from the planet stupid. And he said, global warming, too many factories. I said, okay, I've heard of that. And you know, we walked back down the hill, and I climbed into the Land Rover, and we drove for a couple of days and got back to the airport and got on the airplane and went home to the United States. And, yeah, I knew about global warming. Let me tell you another story from the Himalayas, a brief one, and it won't make sense to you quite yet, but hopefully by the end of the talk it will. A few weeks ago, we opened the email, and there was a picture that had come in from the Buddhist kingdom of Ladakh on sort of the other side of the Himalayas. And it was a picture of 1,500 Buddhist monks and nuns who, at the end of a day-long conference there that they hosted themselves without anyone asking them to, had culminated it by forming a huge human 350. They formed their bodies into this three digits that I'll talk more about, and against the backdrop of these melting, beautiful mountains. And what I'm going to suggest in the course of this talk is that that action they took and other actions like it may be the most important things we can do at this late date to have some chance of dealing with the trouble in which we now find ourselves. To get there, we're going to have to back up a little bit and talk about that trouble. I wrote the first book about climate change, as Simon said. And I wrote it 20 years ago this year, the first book for a general audience. Okay. And at the time, it was a hypothesis still, this idea that we were pouring enough carbon into the atmosphere to materially alter the climate seemed quite scientifically almost obvious. We knew a lot about the molecular structure of CO2. We knew that it trapped heat. On the other hand, it seemed emotionally counterintuitive. How could we have grown large enough as a species to be changing everything that happens on the surface of the Earth? Global warming, of course, is almost a misnomer. What we're really doing is just trapping more of the sun's energy in this narrow envelope of atmosphere, and that energy drives everything that happens on the surface of the Earth except tectonic and volcanic, everything else. Okay? It seems so unlikely that we were that big. And so science went to work from the late 80s into the mid-90s with a vigor with which it's never approached any problem before, with more resources, more brain power. And by about 1995, after sending up weather balloons and satellites, after coring glaciers and pond sediments, after endlessly refining the large computer models that offer us some understanding of what's happening, by about 1995, the world's climatologists were ready to declare a kind of rough and ready consensus. Human beings were heating up the planet, and it was going to be a serious problem. It was a real, in a sense, alarm, a wake-up call. We had become, in short order, very, very large. And in the 10 years since, that and from the period of 1995 to 2005 or 2006, it was as if the planet itself was conducting a peer review of that research to make sure that the scientists had gotten it right. All 10 of the warmest years on record occurred after 1995, and with each year that passed, this consensus deepened and strengthened. Our understanding of what was going on became very deep and very broad. That part of the story, you all know. Okay. The only point I want to get across about the science now is that that consensus has shifted in the last 18 months. And at its cutting edge, that consensus has turned to something that looks a lot like panic among the scientists who are doing the most advanced research on these questions. People that I have talked to, known for a quarter century, the scientists doing this work, who have always been concerned and worried and alarmed, are all of a sudden frightened in a way that you can hear in the tone of their voice when they speak to you on the phone. What's happening is a rapid unraveling of physical systems around the Earth at a much more rapid pace and on a much larger scale than we would have guessed certainly 20 years ago and really even 4 or 5 years ago. Two things are going on that are different than we expected. One, we're seeing far more change from the warming that's occurred than we would originally have predicted. So far, human beings have warmed the planet about 1 degree. Okay? We would have said 20 years ago that 1 degree would be taking us just to the threshold of the global warming era, that we'd be able to start feeling it, but then we'd be kind of looking ahead at real change, another degree or two, and hence some more decades down the road. But it turns out that the Earth was more finely balanced than we realized. We began to get, in very visceral terms, an understanding of that in the summer of 2007, when sea ice in the Arctic began to melt with an almost unbelievable ferocity. Sea ice had been melting steadily for the last 40 years. Each year, there was about 1% less ice coverage by the time the melt season ended. But 2007, it was as if the ice fell off a cliff. By the time the long Arctic night descended in that September, there was 25% less ice than there had ever been before, a melt that was repeated in the summer of 2008 when the Northwest and Northeast passages were opened simultaneously for the first time, not just in human history, but for a very long time before human history. You could circumnavigate the Arctic on open water. We see the same kind of dramatic change in system after system after system. We had a wonderful talk today at the Wilderness Society with people who are doing the job of protecting some of Australia's great forests. I got to tell you about the forests across the top of the other side of the world, across the boreal north, across Canada and Siberia, and then down the Rockies. In Canada and down the Rockies, in the last 3 years, we've seen the death of about 10 million contiguous hectares of forest, not a tree left living in it. These were massive pine forests, the biggest in the world. They've been felled by a little insect called the pine bark beetle that's always been there. It's not a newly introduced species. What's new is the world in which it's living. When the temperature goes to 30 or 40 below for a couple of weeks in the winter, as it always has, that's enough to kill off 98% of them and keep its reproduction in check and hence its damage limited. Those temperatures haven't done that, and so every tree for as far as you can see, for vast areas across British Columbia or Alberta or down the spine of the Rockies into the United States, is now dead. Dead and giving up carbon, its soils giving up carbon, dead and representing the possibility and increasingly the actuality for some of the great forest fires the world has ever seen. Look at the world's hydrological cycles. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold. Okay, that's one of the essential facts of the century into which we now move. That means that in arid areas, we're seeing dramatic increases in evaporation and hence in drought. Okay? You all have a better taste of that in Australia than almost any place in the world. to watch major river systems begin to dry up is one of the scariest things that it's possible to imagine. Okay? With that water evaporating up into the atmosphere, it, of course, comes down someplace else. And so in wet areas, we're seeing deluge and flood on a scale we haven't observed before. Huge storms at my latitude, 45 degrees north, storms that drop more than 2 inches of rain in a 24-hour period have grown 30 or 40% more frequent over the last 30 years. Storms that wash away farmers' fields, that do nobody any good. If you don't want to believe, if you have someone who doesn't want to believe the scientists or the environmentalists about this, ask them to check with the insurance industry, who can show you how payouts have risen exponentially over the last decade and a half as storms of all kinds, including coastal cyclones and hurricanes, become more intense almost with each passing year. So that's one thing that we didn't completely expect, the degree of sensitivity of Earth's systems to that kind of change. The other thing that we didn't fully expect, or maybe that we feared but hoped wouldn't happen, at least on this scale, is the quick identification of a number of virulent feedback loops that take this warming and make it much worse, much faster. I've described one to you. When you melt that ice at the Arctic, it's not just confirmation that we're warming the planet. It's also a way to accelerate that warming and accelerate it profoundly. That nice white mirror across the top of the world that used to reflect 80% of incoming solar radiation back out to space is no longer there. It's now replaced by blue water that absorbs 80% of that incoming solar radiation, and it amps up the whole reaction. Then in the winter, when that water has to refreeze, that freezing process gives off heat, and that heat is transmitted in the process the scientists now call Arctic amplification. You can follow that warming signal easily about 1,500 kilometers inland into the tundra and the taiga. There, as those places warm, the permafrost beneath the soil is melting. And it turns out that stored beneath that permafrost is an almost incalculable reservoir of methane that is now beginning dramatically to leak into the atmosphere. Scientists the last two winters across the boreal north have observed lots of ponds and marshes and things that aren't freezing, even at the depth of winter, even at 40 below. And the reason they're not freezing is because there's so much methane bubbling out through that it keeps them open. Okay, it's like a fountain or something. Those feedback loops, and I could go on talking about other ones for a long time, are scary in large part because they run the risk very quickly of getting beyond our ability to control. That is, we started this process by burning coal and gas and oil and putting carbon in the atmosphere and warming the temperature. That melted the ice. That melted the permafrost. Okay? But even if we did everything right, even if we stopped using coal and gas and oil, past a certain point, and the best guess is that point is right upon us, very close to us, past a certain point, there's nothing we can do to stop these feedback loops from operating. Okay? We have no practical method for refreezing the Arctic. We have no practical method for revivifying those forests. Those things are increasingly beyond our control, and hence we stand much closer to the precipice than we thought we did. All of this depressing science, and it is, no doubt, no question, deeply depressing, this description of our moment on this planet. All of this had, sort of through a series of odd ways, led me, in certain ways, to shift what I was spending my time doing. I've spent 20 years writing and speaking about this topic. But at a certain point, it became clear to me that I needed to do more than just write and speak about it. And I'll tell you a story, again, to explain for me how that happened. Because I really do sort of think in stories. I don't react as well as I should always to reason. Sometimes it's emotion, too, that triggers my reactions. I was spending time in Bangladesh doing a story, again, about a country that will be hard hit by climate change. Surely some of you in this room have been to Bangladesh. It's one of the most beautiful places on Earth, incredibly fertile. It's the delta where the great sacred rivers of Asia, the Ganges and the Brahmaputra, come pouring down out of the Himalaya. Okay. Every August, there's a nice gentle flood that leaves behind a layer of silt, and as a result, the place has a fertility unmatched on the planet. There's 140 million people in a very small area, and the area the size of the American state of Iowa, okay? 140 million people, half, you know, seven times the population of Australia. But they feed themselves because the land is so fertile. They're in big trouble as climate change approaches. Sea level begins to rise. It's already beginning to rise. That pushes the Bay of Bengal further inland. It inundates people's wells. It makes it impossible to farm. At a certain point in this century, we think that as much as half the landmass may be literally uninhabitable. At the same time, the glaciers that are the wellspring of the Ganges and the Brahmaputra up in the Himalayas, as I have told you, are melting. We think they may be gone by mid-century. They supply not only the Ganges and the Brahmaputra, they also supply in an area about the size of Italy, a glaciated Himalayas supplies the Mekong, the Solwin, the Yangtze, and the Yellow. One-third of human beings live downstream, okay, from those glaciers, which are, and there's no, we don't have like a backup plan for what we're going to do to supply them with water when the time comes. But those are chronic problems. When I was in Bangladesh, the problem they were having was acute. They were having their first big outbreak of a disease called dengue fever, a mosquito-borne disease that the World Health Organization says will be the emergent disease of the 21st century because the mosquito that carries it, Aedes aegypti, is remarkably sensitive to changes in heat and humidity and expands its range rapidly. Indeed, the incidence of dengue across Asia and South America is up 200, 300, 400% so far this decade. There's been an outbreak in northern Australia of dengue. Right? When I was there, they were having their first big outbreak in Dhaka, the capital city of Bangladesh. And I was spending a lot of time in the slums, so I got bit by the wrong mosquito, and I got dengue myself. Clearly, I survived, you know. I was healthy and strong going in. Lots of people didn't survive, people who were old or young or malnourished going in, okay? I remember going down to the hospital ward in Dhaka and looking out at this ward, far bigger than this room, really cots almost as far as the eye could see. And on every cot, somebody shivering, and in between every cot on the floor, because there weren't enough cots, other people shivering. And I remember standing there, shivering myself, but looking out at that scene, and my main thought was, these people have done nothing at all to deserve this. The UN tries to measure how much carbon each nation emits in the hope that we will do something about it someday. You can't even really get a number for Bangladesh. It's a rounding error in the calculations. There's 140 million people, but the bicycle rickshaw is how people get around unless they walk. Most people are not connected to the electric grid, okay? They're not pouring carbon into the atmosphere. The 4% of the world that lives in my country produces 25% of the world's CO2. It strikes me as a reasonable moral mathematics to say that one bed in four in that Dhaka hospital ward is on America. And the only country in the world whose citizens manage to produce more carbon per capita than Americans is Australia. So I leave you to your own conclusions about what that means we're grateful to you for topping us in that. The upshot of this story is I came home wanting to do something more, okay? Very cognizant of the fact that 20, by that time, 16 or 17 years of speaking and writing had essentially accomplished nothing. Not in the United States and not in the world, okay? Washington had yet to adopt anything that would significantly reduce carbon emissions at all. The world had signed the Kyoto Treaty, but it clearly was nowhere near the scale of reaction needed, and it wasn't being ratified or followed anyway. It seemed to me that the time to do something was then, but I didn't know what to do. And I'm telling you these stories, which are somewhat embarrassing, because the point of them is, for those of you who have any doubt, if someone as clueless as me could engage in this work, so can all of you. I live in Vermont, a rural state in the northeastern part of the United States, very sparsely populated. I called up a few of my writer friends in Vermont. I said, here's what we're going to do. We'll go up to Burlington, which is our main city. It has 50,000 people, so not much of a city, but it's as good as we've got. Okay. We're going up to Burlington, and we're going to sit in on the steps of the federal building, and we'll be arrested, and there'll be a little story in the paper, and we will have done something. Okay. And all these guys, just as clueless as I am, oh, excellent plan, let's do that. excellent plan. Happily, somebody calls up to the police in Burlington and says, what will happen if we carry out this intrepid writerly stunt, you know? And the police say, nothing will happen, you know. Stay there as long as you like. You know, we'll come visit you. We were like, damn, you know, we have to come up with something else. And so I just started sending out emails to everybody I knew. Say, we're going to go for a walk. Come join us. And a couple of weeks later, we left. We left from, do you all know the American poet Robert Frost? In Vermont, he's sort of our patron saint, you know. And we left from his old summer writing cabin. We thought his most famous poem, The Road Not Taken, was kind of apropos for our situation. So off we marched, and we walked for 5 days, and we slept in farm fields at night. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, so I called up all the Methodist churches, and we, you know, the Methodist mafia all along the route. They let us have, you know, meeting halls to give talks in the evening and stuff. We finally get to Burlington after 5 days of walking, and there's 1,000 of us, okay? Vermont's a very small place. 1,000 people is more people than anyone's really ever seen in one spot before. The cows are bolting in terror from the fence lines as we go by. It's more than enough people to get everybody who's running for Congress and Senate in our old state, this was the fall of 2006, to come down and meet with us. Not only to meet with us, to sign on to this raggedy piece of cardboard that we've been carrying across the countryside that said, if elected, I pledge I will work to cut carbon emissions 80% by mid-century, which at the time was a very radical proposition. Nobody in Washington had anything like that in mind. Only scientists endorsed it, okay? But what do you know? All these people signed, and not just the left Democrats, the quite conservative Republicans. The woman who was running for the Republican on the Republican ticket for Congress had said 2 months before when she announced for office, she said what too many politicians there and here said, I'm not sure that global warming is real. More research needs to be done. Okay? It was useful for us to find out that the more research that needed to be done had very little to do with physics and chemistry and everything to do with the interesting question, how many people will walk across Vermont and ask me to change my mind? Okay? And the empirical answer was, 1,000 is enough, because she signed. It was good. The only not good thing was to open the newspaper the next day and see a story that said these 1,000 people might have been the largest demonstration that had yet taken place in the United States about climate change. At which point we were like, well, no wonder we're not doing so good, you know. We have the superstructure of a movement. We have Al Gore. We have a lot of environmental groups. We have economists. We have, you know, engineers, we have policy people. The only part of the movement that we have forgotten is the movement part, you know? There's nobody there to give it any heft. can we do something about this? So we try. When I say we, I mean me and six undergraduates at the little college in Vermont where I teach, one of whom, my colleague John Warno, is here with me today. We didn't have any money. We didn't have any organization. We just started sending out emails to people saying, will you organize, will you pass this email on, and will you organize something on April 14th of 2007? The 14th, yes, John? Yeah, April 14th. And with the same demand, 80% captain. We hoped we might organize 100 of these across the country, which would have been 100 more than there have been, but we didn't tell anybody that. We didn't want to risk humiliation. Instead, the thing took off. It turned out there were lots of people around the country who were haunted by climate change, but hadn't felt any way to have effective action on a scale that really mattered. They'd kind of figured out, you know, after they changed their light bulbs, that changing their light bulbs was a very good thing to do, wasn't going to solve the problem. But how then to take on something this large? And by giving them a framework, people responded. On April 14th, 3 months later, we had 1,400 simultaneous demonstrations in all 50 states. It was the biggest day of grassroots environmental action since the first Earth Day in 1970 in the states. It was really beautiful. Almost by accident, we sort of hit on this model because we didn't, people, oh, you should have a march on Washington. That's how this is done. Well, we didn't have the resources to do a march on Washington. And we thought there was something a little off about telling people to drive across America to protest climate change. And we thought people would know how to do this best in their own place, communicate this story with the images and places that they had close to home. And so it turned out. Key West, Florida, they only coral reefs in the continental U.S. They did a big underwater demonstration. Lots of people in scuba gear with signs and things. Beautiful videos with fish in it, sort of interspecies political collaboration. You know, it's very good. I was in New York City that morning. We had thousands of people in blue shirts, and we're all holding hands, and it's a human tide line to show people where the water is going to fall across the most expensive real estate on the planet, you know, if the water keeps rising. We have people climbing in big numbers, the great glaciated peaks of the West that aren't going to be glaciated much longer. People in churches. It was fantastic. It was also effective, oddly enough. 3 days later, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton dramatically changed their energy platforms and adopted this goal that we had set for them. Okay? And we're now seeing some of the fruits of that in the early days of the Obama administration. We were feeling quite, I must say, good about ourselves. I believe the technical term would be smug. Okay? And then, 6 weeks later, the Arctic starts to melt. And that forces two realizations on us. One, that even the targets we've been talking about weren't enough to keep pace with the rapid deterioration of physical systems on Earth. And two, that any significant response was going to be global if it was going to be worth anything at all. And we began to think about whether or not it was possible to have a grassroots global movement that covered the whole Earth. Which is a tall order, somewhat ludicrous to even think about. But we had one tool pretty soon. You can read, if you want, some of the backstory on this, the issue of Nature magazine, one of the world's two premier scientific journals that came out, the issue from the week before last, which tells some of the backstory. But we had a number all of a sudden that really provided us the tool we needed. The number came after that melt of Arctic ice. Our leading climatologists, led by Jim Hansen at NASA, and his team went back to look at what both observational data and the mounds of paleoclimatic data that we've now assembled, what they were saying. Okay. He said, they said, and this is, you know, now been corroborated by lots of other people doing the same kind of work, said 350 turns out to be the magic number. 350 parts per million carbon dioxide. Before the Industrial Revolution, the background level of CO2 in the atmosphere is 275 parts per million for all of the Holocene, all of the 10,000 years of human civilization, plus or minus 10 parts per million. We began to raise it up by when we started burning coal and gas and oil, but we never knew where the red line was, and we always hoped that the red line was a little further down the road so that this could be our children's problem to deal with, you know, so that we could kick the can a little further down, so that we could take change that was easier and more economically convenient and didn't rattle any cages, you know, just all that. When the Arctic melted, it became pretty clear that that was not the case. That this was not a future problem, it was a present problem. 350 is a tough, tough number. It's tough because we're already past it. We're at 387 parts per million and rising to 2 parts per million a year. Okay? 350 is an upper bound. It represents no salvation on its own. Doubtless the number will eventually end up being somewhat lower than that, although that's the most that science can conclusively tell us at this point. In any event, what it means is we need a U-turn, and a U-turn fast. We need to be going in the opposite direction. What it means is that it's an emergency, okay? Capital E emergency, with very little time to solve it. It's, I said to someone earlier today, the analogy really goes like this. It's not like going to the doctor, and the doctor says, if you keep eating all this cheese, someday your cholesterol will be too high. Okay? It's not like that. It's like going to the doctor, and the doctor looks at your blood. Your cholesterol is way too high, and you're in that zone where you're going to have a heart attack or a stroke, and you better get it down right now, and you better hope that you get it down before the heart attack or the stroke comes. Well, the heart attacks and the strokes are coming. That's what it means when you have 2 weeks of the warmest weather that anyone's ever recorded in Australia, and then the bush catches fire. That's what it means when your rivers start disappearing. That's what it means when the Arctic melts, when 10 million hectares of trees die. That's what it means when the ocean, the pH of the ocean, begins to change and change dramatically to turn acid. The time in which we have to deal with this is surpassingly short. We don't know exactly what the cutoff date is, but the best estimates are scary as an understatement. Rajendra Pachauri, the Indian-born head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who accepted the Nobel alongside Al Gore 2 years ago, said recently that he thinks that if we have not begun to make very fundamental reforms in the energy architecture of the planet by 2012, then we will never be able to get ahead of this curve again. And in realistic terms, the time is shorter than that. The world gathers in Copenhagen in December of this year, there to draw up a new treaty on climate. From what we know now about the science of global warming, it is our last plausible bite at the apple of getting that architecture right. If we're not able very soon to make those basic changes, then those trajectories of those feedback loops will be great enough that we will not get back ahead of that curve, that we will instead spend the rest of the century and indeed centuries to come adapting to that which we did not prevent or trying to adapt, because adaptation gets pretty damn hard. We've raised the temperature 1 degree already. The scientific consensus is that we're looking at another 4 or 5 degrees this century unless we take action soon. Okay? So, it's very useful to us to have this number for two reasons. One, it sets a bar. It means that when we talk with our leaders as they go to Copenhagen, it's not enough for them simply to tell us that they're going to take action on global warming, that they're going to sign a global warming treaty. That is not what we need. Okay? What we need them to do is to sign something strong enough to eventually get us back to 350, to head us in the right direction, not to lock us into a scenario where we never get back there. It sets a real bar. a bar for the whole world. And that's the second reason a number is useful. If you're going to try and organize the whole planet, you better not try to do it with words, because people all over the earth annoyingly insist on speaking their own languages. This is a major problem if you're trying to reach them all. Only musical notation and Arabic numerals cross linguistic boundaries with ease. And so we're doing our best to make use of both, but especially of that number. Because it means the same thing wherever you go. It gets through to people in the same way. And that's what we need your help here with. I'm going to end just by asking for that help. I know that people here are already organizing, that there's a wonderful and robust climate movement in Australia. In fact, the rest of the world stands in certain ways in awe of that movement. It's the one place in the world where you forced election to be fought, at least in part, on the issue of global warming. And it's been great fun in the last week moving around Australia to get to meet many of the players and many of the groups, to be at Friends of the Earth or at Greenpeace or at ACF or at the Wilderness Society or at Beyond Zero Emissions, to spend a lot of time with the people, the young people at GetUp, and get them, really connect and partner with them about this campaign. It's been really, really fun to get to know the young people here at the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, who are doing really bravura work, really helping to set the tempo for change here. As in so many places, it's now young people who are really taking some of the leadership in these things. It's great to see all the stuff that's going on. It was wonderful to have somebody hand me a flyer today saying we're going to have a big human sign on St. Kilda Beach Sunday. Yes? Sunday at 11. Be there. And it'll be beautiful. And it'll be even more beautiful and effective if down in the corner there's a big 350, you know? Because we love when those monks and nuns did that. We love when anybody does that. When anybody puts a number on their demand, puts a bottom line on their desire, translates their hope into something that we can act on as a world. We need you for one day, October 24th of this year, October 24th of this year, to join with the rest of the planet in one great day of action. We cannot solve this thing one light bulb at a time. We can address it that way, but we can't solve it. We cannot even solve it one country at a time anymore. We can address it that way, but we can't solve it. We need the power of the global movement to make it happen. And that possibility exists for the first time. If you want to know why the internet was invented, okay, it was not so that you could play poker in your underwear all night. It was so that we could take this most important fact and spread it around the world and then get people to do real things on the ground with it. By real things, there will be people high up in the Himalayas. Hopefully there'll be 350 scuba divers on the Great Barrier Reef. There'll be people high up in the trees in Tasmania. There will be things going on all over the world, big cities, small towns. There'll be hundreds and hundreds of thousands of churches ringing their bells 350 times. We're having great involvement from faith communities of all kinds. There'll be every sort of thing that you can imagine. And the thing that will make it really work is if there is, for one day anyway, unity. Among all the people who are working on this problem together. Look at this country, which has, among other things, this beautiful movement of local climate action groups in cities and towns all across Australia, a real model for how we can operate together, hand in hand with big environmental groups, with the youth movement, with the faith community, for once joining in one solid message and joining with people all over the world in that message. It is too much to ask the disparate governments of the world to take on the very hard task of agreeing on something that works for all of them if the environmental movement can't, at least for a day, model that kind of behavior itself, you know? That's a kind of beginning bottom line. The day will begin in Australia, okay, and continue on around the globe. What you do here will be of extraordinary importance because those are the images that assignment editors at TV networks and things all over the world will be looking at as they try to see how much coverage they're going to give this thing. So we need for you to figure out how to make it happen. I have no doubt that you will. We were spent the last 2 weeks, first in New Zealand and then here, and every place we went, people knew just what we were talking about. We were in New Zealand a day. We were in Dunedin. And people, oh, no problem, we're going to get 350 surfers out on the break. You know, we were someplace else in New Zealand, they said, we're going to do something with 350 sheep. I don't know what, I didn't ask any questions about what they planned, but there it was. Let me end by saying two things. One is, I cannot promise you that this will work. There are scientists who think we've waited too long to get started and that the momentum of these physical systems is already too strong. And there are also those who think that the power of vested interest to delay and slow down this action is simply too great to overcome. We are taking on the most powerful part of the world's economy. Okay? And we have to do it, unlike any other social problem we've ever faced, quickly. When Americans think about movements, they always think back to the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. King. Okay. And Dr. King was way braver in the people who worked with him than we have to be. No one's going to shoot you for talking about global warming. But they had the great luxury of knowing that they would win in the end. You've heard that talk that Dr. King gave the night before he was shot, that sermon in Memphis. I've been to the mountaintop. I have seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but you will get there. He always said at the end of every talk, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We will win eventually. Well, the arc of the physical universe is short, and it bends toward heat, and it's bending that way fast now, and if we do not do this soon, then we will not do it. I can't promise you that we're going to win, but I can absolutely promise you that we are going to give it one hell of a try. We opened the email the other day, and there was a picture from a farmer in the Cameroon in West Africa who had heard about this. He'd seen the 90-second wordless video that we made, which maybe we'll show you in a second. And he'd somehow seen it on his cell phone screen, not in the internet, but the cell phone works. Even in the most remote villages now, someone's got one, okay? And he'd understood it. And he and his neighbors had gotten together, and they had planted 350 trees on the edge of their village and hung a little sign on it. That's useful for us. We got the picture on the front page of the Cameroonian, or whatever the newspaper is, okay? But more than that, it was so moving to see that. Because you know for sure that nobody in the Cameroon is causing global warming, okay? This is not their fault. But they understand that in the connected world in which we now live, there is some possibility that they will play a role in bringing it to an end. And you have that possibility too. This is the most dangerous moment in human history, and hence, in some ways, the most exciting. No need to look back on other times and the fights that other people have fought. This fight is bigger than all of those. And it is in our power still, if only a little while longer, to dramatically affect how that fight ends. I thank you enormously for joining us in it.
Passionate talk and call to action. I know personally and also a lot of other young people I work with have been extremely inspired with what you've done with the Step It Up campaign and the young people that you've worked with across America to achieve what you have. So thank you for that. And I know that your tour has been very quick and very whirlwind. So I think everyone here appreciates that you've made the time to talk to us in Melbourne. And I'm very excited about October 24th now. Before we take questions for Bill, I just wanted to draw your attention to one of the organisations who will be organising actions on October 24th. I know there are a lot here today. I know the Wilderness Society, the Climate Action Groups, and many, many other groups will be organising actions that you can get involved in if you don't want to organise your own. But I work with a youth group called the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, and we're a coalition of 27 of the largest youth organisations around the country, and we're working to see a good global agreement in Copenhagen and putting pressure on the government to make sure the domestic policies are right to help make that happen. And one of the biggest things that we're doing this year is an event called Power Shift. And it's based on something that happened in the US where they had 12,000 young people converge on Washington to demand strong climate action from their government. And we're modelling that here. So from the 11th to the 13th of July, we'll be getting 3,000 young people to go to Sydney, and we'll hold the largest youth climate summit that the country's ever seen. So I'd love for you to get involved in that. There's 300 of you here, so by my calculations, if you all convince 10 of your young friends to come along, we would have reached our target. So if you're interested in helping out with Power Shift, there'll be speakers and workshops. We've got Tim Flannery speaking, Al Gore and Rajendra Pachauri have agreed to appear by video link. And we'll also have some great, big, colourful actions to get young people to stand up against climate change. And people from Cairns right down to Launceston are already organising to come. So it would be great to have a really strong Melbourne presence there. So just come and talk to me if you want to hear more about that. Or you can also have a look on our website. Now we might take some questions for Bill.
Before we take questions, Bill would like to show a short video. Just 3 minutes or so?
Sure. No, it's even less than that. And I show it only so you can get a sense of how people... We had to figure out how to get the word out without using words and how to do something, how to get across both a complicated scientific and political message. And this is... It's now been seen, you know, approximately a zillion times on YouTube and whatever. It seems to be doing the trick. It gives you some sense of the kind of energy that's gathering, I think.
Sorry.
It works really best on cell phones, I must say.
Well, Bill, every bike rider is very proud to be associated with your video. As your hosts tonight, I suppose one of the most exciting things is that there are people here from all walks of life, and that we have here people who are students at the university and staff, researchers, people from governments and NGO, and we'd like the questions to reflect that range if possible. Also, I think Bill's given a terrific example of purposeful interaction. So please, could you make your question brief, purposeful, and if you want to express a point of view, could you just hold back? Okay, anyone have questions? Good. I think starting with the fact that young people are leading the movement, can we take your question, please?
Bill, if you were handed the crown of the benevolent dictatorship of the world and your job started tomorrow...
There's your first mistake, yes. Yeah.
What exactly would you do to bring us back to 350?
Well, that's a very, very good question, and of course in many ways beyond my capacity to answer. The first thing to be said is, for those of you who are thinking, well, we'll never get back below... It is possible. Of course, the Earth soaks up carbon. Forests and oceans cycle carbon out. That's what they do. The problem is we're pouring in far more than they can deal with, and hence the number keeps rising. So we need the very quick transition away from fossil fuels. What the data seems to indicate is that the world isn't out of the business of burning coal by 2030, and the Western world well before that. We will have put so much carbon into the atmosphere we won't get back. So that's no small proposition, changing on a dime, as it were, the world's energy systems, the most integral part of our economy. The only lever big enough to really have any chance of moving that, and the thing that we've known for a long time we would need to do, is make the price of carbon reflect the cost it exacts on the environment. Okay? And that's a very important thing to do. That's where all these international negotiations and all the sort of national policy and whatever at some level is headed. And we have to make sure that that price is stiff enough to get this transition really moving. You get some sense of how that can happen when you look at things like what happened in the United States last year when the price of gasoline doubled in the course of a couple of months. Now, some of us had been working for 20 years against sport utility vehicles, okay, with some success, but really not very much. It took about 6 weeks of those high gas prices to cause tens of millions of Americans to drop the fantasy that they were forest rangers and find some other way of moving their bodies through the world, you know, get on buses, whatever, carpool, whatever it was. It was quite amazing, the reaction, and our use of fuel went down very sharply for the first time since we discovered how to drive 100 years before. You know, what we now know about the world is that if we could get that price of coal, which sets the kind of floor against which all else is measured, if we could get it to change substantially, we have the technologies to do much of what we need doing. I mean, the first set of technologies that would quickly come into play are the ones about conservation, right? Suddenly there would be people ringing you up at home offering to come, you know, insulate your home to within an inch of its life, and you would be very receptive to the idea because you'd be getting a strong price signal to do so. And, you know, that's almost, in a way, the good news. Americans and Australians and others sort of outside of Western Europe are such energy wastrels that the first part of this is relatively easy. I mean, it's like losing weight by getting a haircut, you know? You don't have to change an enormous amount of your life. Beyond that, once we get those numbers down, and remember, the average Western European uses half as much energy as the average American or Australian, so there's lots of room in that direction. Once we've done that, then the sort of array of soft technologies that we have, wind and sun chief among them, seem much more possible. Wind is already the fastest growing source of electric generation around the world, and its climb will only steepen if we get prices right. Australia is deeply blessed with sun, with wind, with the heat of the earth not far below the crust, with the power of the rise and fall of tides, you all will be fine. You just have to stop with the coal, and that's hard to do because it's so cheap that it will remain a temptation for us to use until the point at which we put it on a high enough shelf that we can no longer reach it.
Thank you. Further questions? Up the back, Peter Christoph.
I speak.
Just speak. I'll translate.
Thank you very much. That was very. I've got to confess that I'm associated with the Australian Constellation Foundation, and that was a cold. And as you may have known, we've been through a fairly turbulent week in politics around the Indigenous training scheme in the academy. It's very clear, particularly in the Australian context, that politicians listen to political pain. And while I'd love to see 350,000 people out in the streets of Australia, my guess is that 3,500 marginal seats would probably have a greater impact. I'm just wondering what, in the American context, given that we seem to be immune to public pressure broadly and generally expressed, I'm just wondering what works in the United States and what advice
well,
you might give us.
That's a very good... I mean, when we organized this Step It Up thing, okay, one of the reasons we didn't do the March on Washington was because we wanted people to know in their districts that people cared about this. And we did something the next day. Everybody was uploading images to the web, and that's what's going to happen on October 24th all over the world. It'll be quite beautiful. We'll have a huge screen at the UN and some other places. And on the web, you'll be able to watch kind of the day move across the world. And that'll be quite, by the way, empowering to local people who labor under the difficulty that all of us labor under of not quite understanding, you know, of worrying that whatever we do, it's not going to add up to enough, you know. Even in Australia, well, we're only 1% of the problem, what difference does it make? Well, suddenly you'll see that difference being made. But politicians respond, as you say, to particular pain from particular places. So the next day, we had pictures printed up. Each, you know, if there were 10 demonstrations in Kansas, there were copies of those delivered to the Kansas Congress people at their offices the next day of those pictures so they could see what... Because when there's a big march on Washington, say, most people assume, and fairly rightly, that it's people from New York and Washington who are doing the marching, you know, and not people from Kansas. So that was quite useful and something, of course, to think about as you're planning stuff here. And I got to say, we had it was painful to get off the plane from Auckland, and the first thing I had was a copy of the newspaper with the story about the Prime Minister's backing down, and the third paragraph sort of demonstrating how easily and neatly he'd managed to split the Green movement. That happens all over the world, and the only antidote for it is to find things on which we really can agree. And this 350 number better be that, okay? It reminds us, and this is an important thing to keep in mind, an important way to think about this, at least for me. The negotiations now underway in Canberra, in Copenhagen, in Washington, are not, in the end, negotiations between industry and environment, between different wings of the environmental movement, between China and America. Those negotiations are all going on, and Copenhagen will be the most significant human negotiation ever, more important than Yalta or Versailles, because its outcome will be measured in geological time. Okay, but the real negotiation that's underway is between human beings on one side and physics and chemistry on the other side. Okay. And the trouble with that negotiation is that physics and chemistry don't negotiate. Okay? They just do. Congress, you know, Parliament, the Labour Party, the National Party, none of them have the power to amend the laws of nature. Okay? They can amend the tax code, but they can't amend the laws of nature. And that's what we have to keep reminding each other. Hence, trying to find some ground where diverse movements and diverse expectations of the world can come together is very, very important, and that's why that sort of grounding to us is so important.
Janet Rice from the Greens. But do you actually have hope that people in the mainstream political parties are capable of making that change? not committed myself to the Greens for the last 17 years because I just don't see it happening in last week's carryings on in Canberra. Made that all too obvious.
I actually read a quite excellent essay by that fellow Guy Pearce in the Monthly, that explained a lot. I recommend to you that it explains a lot about Australian climate realities, it seemed to me, or at least some about it. In the States and elsewhere, I think the answer to that is, at the moment, no. Okay? But we don't have the luxury of changing in some huge way any of the systems that we're dealing with in the time that we have to deal with this problem. Okay? So, for instance, if you said to me, wouldn't it be easier if we had an alternate religious world where we were mostly had, you know, a sort of nature-based spirituality? Okay, it would, you know. But we're not going to have that in the 3 or 4 or 5 years that we have. We're going to work with what we have, which turns out to be, rallied in the right way, enough. We can make do with the, you know, with Judaism and Christianity and Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism. Okay? They have the resources we need. People say, wouldn't it be easier if we had some other economic structure under which we operate? And it would. I spend a lot of my time thinking about local economies and how we're going to get there. And I think that's where we're headed in 40 or 50 years. But we're not going to get there in time for that. We're going to deal with the structure we have, which is why price is so important. Same with political structures, okay? It seems very unlikely to me that we're going to see huge and wholesale change in them in the time we have, so we have to work the ones that we do. And I do think that those systems will respond if there is enough pressure on them, okay? It has to be a lot more pressure than they're getting now. There have to be, that's why we need a mass movement. Now, one way of thinking about this that's a little less daunting is, it's very hard in each country, every country in the world has the equivalent of Australia's dominant coal industry, okay? New Zealand has agriculture. The U.S. has the, well, we don't really have the car industry anymore. We used to have the car industry, you know. Everybody has deep, in some ways, it's easier, or it's a very good complement to the work you're doing, the sort of head-on bashing that you're doing in Australia, to also have this global movement putting pressure kind of on everyone at once from every direction. At a certain level, our leaders are going to have to arrive in Copenhagen and all hold hands and jump at once if we're going to get real change. And it may be somewhat easier to do that in that context if they feel big global pressure. It'll also help enormously if you're able, through things like 350, to put some real pressure on the Americans and on the Chinese, who more than anyone else will be cutting the bargain that we eventually get to. And if they cut that bargain, then they will politely explain to Mr. Rudd what it is he needs to do, you know. And there'll be very little chance to seriously resist that, you know, coming down. That's, again, not fair or right, but that's how the world that we live in works politically. And those laws aren't as immutable as the laws of chemistry and physics, but they're not going to change in huge ways in the time that we have. And so I guess what I'm saying is, don't completely give up hope, either domestically or globally. The question is, can we build a movement large enough? And I'll just end that by saying, the reason that we're having so much trouble is that the environmental movement isn't scaled for this kind of work, okay? We're scaled to save whales, to protect national parks, to do very noble things, but not things that attack the center of the world's economy. And we need more than we have now.
Thank you. The man in the red tie.
Just a few words on clean coal.
Yes. Clean coal. At the moment, a complete contradiction in terms. And likely to remain so as in any useful time. Look, there's money, a little bit, being invested in trying to figure out if we can do carbon sequestration and storage. But it doesn't look good so far. And the reason is that it's a huge problem in materials handling, okay? Because that carbon
atom combines with two oxygen atoms when it's combusted. If you bring a train car load of coal into a power station, you have to take out 2.5 train car loads full of CO2 and find something to do with it. The cost of doing that is so high that by that time, you're almost certainly better off putting up windmills and solar panels. Okay, it'll only happen with enormous government expenditure to prop up an existing industry instead of the much smarter government expenditure, if there's going to be some, to build the next set of industries. Trying to keep alive the 18th century technology that is coal simply because there's people with big money invested in it is not a very good use of what, you know, the ever more limited resources that we have. I mean, given that George Bush has burned up a large percentage of the world's money in the last 4 or 5 years, we've got to figure out cheap things to do. And that's probably not on the list of cheap things at this point, even if it is possible.
Well, questions are bubbling like methane in a pond.
I'd like to take yours. What do you think about the idea of trying to shift out of politics as usual to some kind of emergency mode or using that language with our politicians?
Well, that's sort of what we're trying to do, in a way, with this 350 thing, is say this is an emergency. And it may need to go. I mean, we were talking today about, with very committed people who were, you know, at zero emissions now and things, who were talking about, you know, maybe we're going to do civil disobedience, get 350 people arrested at a coal fire. And I'm not saying that's wrong at all. There's lots of room to do that. We just did this civil disobedience thing outside the coal-fired power plant in Washington that operates, and we won, actually. They agreed to shut down the power plant when we put 5,000 people out there, and it's not going to burn coal anymore, which was nice. We don't need everybody to do that. Barriers to entry for this kind of activity have to be low, too, okay? So that everybody can take part. So some people can be sitting down in front, but there's got to be room for people to be standing with their kids on the beach, 350 strong, holding hands, showing the line in the sand, or whatever it is, okay? It is an emergency, which means we have to not only react dramatically, we have to react very, very astutely and figure out how to both deepen and broaden participation at once. But I will say, I'll tell you a quick story. I was arrested years ago in the first climate demonstration that anybody got arrested at in the United States, and it was very puny and very. And the only reason I went was because the woman who called it was this great hero of mine, this woman who at the age of 90 had walked across America to protest global warming. Okay, America's a large place, and she had, you know, taken her a couple of years, but she'd gotten there. She called me up and said, Billy, come down to Washington. We're going to do a demonstration. You should be there. Well, you know, I'm a well-raised Methodist. If a 93-year-old person tells me to do something, I generally do it. And I went down, and we held a sign, she and I, that said, stop global warming, stop campaign contributions from global warmers. And we were holding it in the rotunda of the Capitol, which turns out to be closer than they wish you to sort of exercise your First Amendment rights about free speech and things. So we were arrested. Not only were we arrested, we were handcuffed together, which was very funny because she's about 4'6", okay? So we're like this. And she looks up at me. She has emphysema, too, which makes the whole Walk Across America thing even more insane. She looks up. Gosh, I'm 93 years old. I've never been arrested before. I should have started long ago. So I hear what you're saying. Figure out all the things that work, okay? And figure out all the things that let everybody participate of all kinds.
I have a very practical question. I spent several hours at 350.org last night. And it was very easy to find out how to register an event onto your map, but it was very difficult to find out about the people who had already registered an event.
Boy, am I glad that our webmaster is here today. Where did John go?
I went to Facebook, but I still couldn't find an easy way.
I think the answer is that within a week it will be very easy to do that. Yes?
That's
the answer.
Wonderful.
Yes, it will soon be very even easier than it is now.
Very useful yes. feedback. Thanks.
Yes.
Political speech, which is you know, economics. But it seems to me that it's more, I'm an aspiring social scientist, so I guess it seems more important to me to focus on social and cultural changes that we have to make. So I'm interested in how you see us balancing the social and cultural with the political and economic.
So give me an example of the kind of social and cultural change. There you go. Or maybe let's think about that, or let's think about maybe how to get people to eat less meat, since that's a huge, you know, part of things. Okay. As it turns out, I wrote a book years ago called Maybe One, An Argument for Single Child Families. And the way it turns out to one of the ways it turns out to get people to have fewer children is simply to inquire as to why they're having as many as they are. The biggest reason that people give for having in the Western world more than one child is because they're afraid their first child will be an only child and that'll be bad for them. Okay? And that book was devoted to the proposition that proving, which turned out not to be very hard to do, that all the myths about only children are completely ridiculous. And there's no way you can statistically distinguish an only child from a child with siblings by the time they're 20 or something. They're identical. Okay? And as a result, not as a result of that book, although it was a small part of it, there was a story actually yesterday saying that the single child family is the most fast-growing unit that we have in the Western world, which is very good news, you know. It must be said that population is not what's driving global warming mostly at this point. Population is consumption growth that's driving the problem that we're in. So let's think about consumption. Let's think about something like meat. We think that 18% or so of our climate emissions come in one form or another from the industrial livestock industry. Large, you know, some of it methane emitted by animals, a lot of it oil that we use to grow corn that we then feed to them, okay? There's two ways to go about doing that. One is to try to convince people to become vegetarian or vegan or whatever, which is a completely useful thing to do. It's just going to happen too slowly to make the difference that we need in the atmosphere. I mean, people have been at it for a long time. You know, some of them, Peter Singer here, very, very eloquently and ably, but it's not yet and won't be in the 2 or 3, 4 years that we have it. So one of the other ways to approach this is to think about what the root condition is that allows that kind of industrial livestock industry to prosper. And more than anything else, it's the availability of cheap fossil fuel. I mean, essentially, we feed cows oil and get meat in return. That's how it works. And the minute that you remove that variable, the minute you stick a real price on carbon, okay, that's the moment at which the industrial livestock industry begins to collapse, and we either eat less meat, or we eat locally grown meat, or we eat meat the way that every other culture in the world does, you know, a little bit at a time as a kind of flavoring for food instead of the, you know, great honking slab culinary technique favored by Americans and Australians, and, you know. Those, I think, are the ways that some of those changes will be made, too. It's really worth remembering that the decisive moment in modern human history was the moment when we learned to burn fossil fuel, and that almost everything about our lives follows from that. If an alien landed in Melbourne today and had to report back to his planet about what he had found, he would say, among other things, that he had discovered a sort of bipedal species that combusts fossil fuel, that that's its main purpose. That's who we are right now, you know. Everything that we do involves burning fossil fuel. And hence, to some degree, attitude follows, you know, will follow the availability or not of that resource. That's as good as, I mean, the other part of me works on the long, slow change that I'm really happy to see happening. And it is happening. In America, the fastest growing part of the food economy is local farmers' markets. Okay? It's beautiful to see happening. It'll become far more rapid, that growth, the day that it doesn't have to compete against the insane cheapness of industrial food.
So having questioned the assumptions that we've lived by for such a long time, perhaps we could take a philosophical question. Jeremy.
I was just wondering whether you had any thoughts about how you might achieve the 350 target without watering it down, but where the methods you used to achieve it didn't have an undue impact on the poor. I mean, not just the
yes, no, absolutely. What a key question, okay? Because, I mean, and let's really talk about, I mean, when we talk about the poor, what we're talking about more than anything else are the four-fifths of the world that living in real poverty in much of the developing world, okay, or three-fifths of the world. This is the first set of negotiations to which they will come with some real power. China and India don't play, you know. They can raise the carbon level, and nothing you can do in Australia to slow down global warming if China and India don't want to, and they understand that, okay? They also understand around the developing world that they are going to be first in line for the punishment that comes from a warming world, which is why the LDC, the Less Developed Countries Bloc, and the Association of Small Island States Bloc are both have endorsed firmly this 350 target, okay? They understand that their absolute survival is at stake, and that if we're not able to... But it's not good enough to just, you know, say, okay, we won't put more carbon in it. We have to provide ways for people to develop decent lives without burning the coal that they have close to hand. Any workable treaty coming out of Copenhagen will at some level have to transfer resources from rich to poor, mostly in the form of technology, if it's going to work. Think about, I mean, the only useful model I can ever think of is the Marshall Plan at the end of World War II. Okay? When the U.S., through some mixture of idealism and shrewd pragmatism, transferred a lot of resources to the countries that had just fought, in some cases defeated, in the Second World War, and thereby spurred the possibility for real prosperity to replace the aftermath. Something like that, some carbon version of the Marshall Plan, is what will come out of Copenhagen if Copenhagen's going to work. And it's going to be the biggest stumbling block of all the many stumbling blocks. And it's the reason that we should be, you know, in retrospect, I mean, of course we should have been ashamed all along that we've allowed the incredible inequality to spring up in this world that we have allowed, the gulf between rich and poor. But now we're going to pay, I mean, we may pay an incredibly high, not just moral, but practical price for that. It's the thing that's going to make solving this problem the hardest, because people begin from such different places.
Thanks very much. I'm afraid we've come to the end of question time.